A verse from an ancient psalm and a stanza from a modern poem kept running through my mind as I watched the noisy and turbulent proceedings of the United Nations in recent weeks. The verse was from the second psalm, Lamarakshu Goyim Ulumim Yegurik. Why are the nations in an uproar? And why do the peoples utter vain and foolish things? And the stanza of the modern poem was from Kipling's Recessional. The tumult and the shouting dies. The captains and the kings depart. Still stands thine ancient sacrifice, an humble and a contrite heart. Nearly all the nations of the world were gathered at the United Nations. 98 of them, 99 of them, great and small nations, young and old nations. Some of them fledgling nations, hardly able to stand on their own feet as yet. In many instances, these nations were represented by their captains and their kings, their chiefs of state, their ministers, their presidents, their leaders, and their dictators. A special summons apparently had gone out to marshal the principles of several of the member nations, the top flight men, so as to achieve, if not a de jure summit, a conference as it were, then a de facto conference on a summit level. For this, the 15th Assembly of the United Nations. Never were so many dignitaries present at an assembly of the UN. Never in the history of the world had so many notables representing so many nations and holding so much power assembled under one roof. As a dramatic spectacle, as a pageant of history, it was breathtaking in its colorful sweep, unprecedented, superb. Now the sessions of the 15th Assembly of the UN are by no means over, but the captains and the kings have departed. As one looks back upon the sessions of the first few weeks of the assembly, one gains the impression, unfortunately, and one retains the impression, that all this pomp and circumstance and all their tumult and their shouting was in the nature of a prearranged international circus, a calculated series of propaganda acts in three rings or more, a mammoth series of display floats carefully planned to impress, perhaps to frighten certainly to bring into the communist orbit, the Soviet orbit, the uncommitted neutralist states, especially the newly admitted states of Africa and Asia, who may be holding at the moment the balance of power at the United Nations. And this show, the United Nations is not intended to be a place of show and exhibitions and propaganda. This show was planned and executed by Mr. Khrushchev, a shrewd, cunning, resourceful communist trained under Stalin, who knows all the tricks and all the tactics of communist propaganda and has even improved upon them. Do not be misled by this table thumping and all this shoe slamming on the desks. Khrushchev may have at times the manners of a peasant, a crude peasant, and may, when he is aroused or when he runs out of arguments, use the language of the gutter. He called the Ten Nations Disarmament Commission a stable. He called the Security Council a spittoon. He called the Philippine delegate to express the opinion that the Soviet satellite state should also be included in a UN discussion of colonialism. He called him a jerk and a lackey. He called the President of the United States a liar. But Mr. Khrushchev is no fool and no buffoon. He knows what he's about. He knows that the communist bloc at the United Nations is outnumbered, that it is in the minority, and that through parliamentary methods and the democratic process, he will not achieve his objectives, whatever they may be. And he therefore resorts to the well-known and frequently employed communist tactics of creating disorder and sabotage to disrupt and to discredit the parliamentary machinery, to make it inoperative, to make it suspect, to make it contemptible, to walk out when things go against you, or to refuse to pay your share of the responsibility which is assumed in a United Nations decision, in the hope that his minority bloc, in the confusion, will take over, and failing in that, destroy the UN altogether. Now, the communist attitudes towards national parliaments are well known. They were defined by the Second Comintern Congress in 1920. And I should like to quote a paragraph or two of the decision of the Comintern with reference to how communists should conduct themselves within a parliamentary frame or setup. It is no argument, says the Comintern resolution, it is no argument against participation in the parliamentary struggle that parliament is a bourgeois state institution. The Communist Party does not enter this institution to function there as an organic part of Parliament, but in order by action inside Parliament to help the masses to shatter the state machine and Parliament itself. Communism, declare the Comintern, denies the possibility of winning Parliament over permanently. Its object, therefore, is to destroy parliamentarianism. It follows that communism can be concerned only with exploiting bourgeois state institutions with the object of destroying them. Activity inside a parliament is held to consist chiefly in revolutionary agitation from the parliamentary tribune, in exposing enemies, in the ideological mobilization of the masses, who particularly in the backward areas are still encumbered with democratic illusions. Furthermore, every communist member of parliament must bear in mind that he is not a legislator seeking agreement with other legislators, but a party agitator sent into the enemy camp to execute party decisions. These are the basic tactics of orthodox communism. Mr. Khrushchev is now applying these tactics not to a national parliament, but to what you might call an international parliament, like the UN. The policy is still either ruin or rule. Use it when it is advantageous to you. Undermine it when it no longer serves the purpose. This was behind Mr. Khrushchev's onslaught on Secretary General Hammarskjöld. Not a personal grudge against the man. It was an attack upon the institution of the Secretary General within the United Nations. He was a key post, undoubtedly the most important post in the United Nations, beyond the reach of a Soviet veto. The Secretary General himself, as you know, formulates no policies, but he is called upon impartially to carry out the decisions of the United Nations and of the Security Council. This means, of course, that the majority of the United Nations will guide the activities of the Secretary General, as must be the case in any democratic institution. Mr. Khrushchev, who is not in the majority, but in the minority, and fears that his minority is a permanent minority within the UN, resolved to change it by gaining control of the executive branch of the UN, of the Secretary Generalship. He accordingly demanded that the office of the Secretary General be abolished, that it be replaced by a collective executive of three men, one from the Soviet bloc, one from the so-called neutralist bloc, one from the West, each having a veto power. Here was a scheme either for dominating the UN executive, failing that, of weakening and paralyzing it, or introducing political maneuvering and partisanship within an office whose successful functioning depends upon its being impartial, objective. Now the United Nations is now 15 years old, and it has an experience of 15 years. and it may be in need of certain adjustments. The Charter of the United Nations itself makes provision for a periodic review of the structure, the apparatus of the UN. The membership of the United Nations has nearly doubled since its founding, from 51 to some 99. And the tasks of the Secretary General have enormously increased. And there may be need for a better geographic distribution of its staff. It may be found advisable to enlarge the membership of the Security Council. But that is not what Mr. Khrushchev had in mind. That isn't what he was aiming at. He was seeking for a shortcut by which the communist bloc, a minority, would directly influence and control the work of the United Nations by the force of the veto, actually dominate it, and failing in that, to weaken it, to paralyze it, practically to scrap it. Mr. Khrushchev's repeated and violent attacks on the United States, attacks which were echoed by quite a number of his satellite henchmen, were not directed so much to principle or merit or as a means of negotiating. They were intended simply to blacken the character of the leading member of the Western Alliance, the United States, in the eyes of the uncommitted neutral states, and to persuade them to line up with the communist bloc. It was brash and brazen propaganda of the old communist vintage. One might say Bolshevik vodka, 100% proof. I rather think that Mr. Khrushchev overplayed his hand at this session of the United Nations. The representatives of the new and still neutral governments know. They know full well. They're not babes in the wood. They're not uninformed children. But while the United States may not be all that the United States would like them to believe about it, the United States is still not a grasping colonial imperialist power, wicked or corrupt. Many of these countries are receiving help, substantial help, in the form of financial aid, of technical aid from the United States. They know that the United States is not out to grab them or to exploit them. They were not taken in by Mr. Khrushchev. So that on all of Mr. Khrushchev's proposals, in the main, they refused to go along with him. Mr. Khrushchev lost out on his proposal to take up immediately in the plenum of the assembly, not in the political committee, which is made up of the same number of representatives as the United Nations Assembly itself, 98 or 99 representatives, but where things are discussed more deliberately, more quietly, in greater detail, without the press and the television of the world, watching every move, counting every word. Mr. Khrushchev lost out on his proposal to take up immediately in the plenum of the assembly the disarmament question. He lost out that in his proposal that the United States apologize before the Assembly of the United Nations for the U-2 spy flight. He lost out on his demand to abolish the office of the Secretary General. He lost out on the proposal that the question of Hungary should not be taken up for discussion by the United Nations. Mr. Khrushchev can derive little comfort from the fact that his resolution, which demanded immediate freedom for all colonies everywhere, should be debated by the Assembly, that resolution was adopted. There's little comfort there for Mr. Khrushchev. The United States also voted for it, as did the other members of the Western Alliance. It was a unanimously adopted resolution because it was clearly stated that included in the discussion of colonialism would be the question of the Soviet satellite imperialist colonialism. And on the strength of that inclusion, that proposal was adopted. Mr. Khrushchev's resolution on the admission of Red China, which was defeated, received more favorable votes this year than in any previous year. But the new states voting in favor of a discussion of the admission of Red China, like the Scandinavian countries, were not influenced by Mr. Khrushchev's harangue against the United States or by their pro-Soviet leanings, which they have not, but by the sound reasoning that the United Nations should include all de facto governments in actual control of the political machinery of their several states, whether we like them or not. The UN should be the universal body of all the nations of the earth. I have for years, as you may recall, advocated the admission of Red China into the United Nations. I still do. It would be most unfortunate in my mind if its admission, which appears to be inevitable, would come about as the result of Soviet initiative and against the wishes of the United States. But these setbacks, my friends, for Mr. Khrushchev, ought to give us no particular sense of satisfaction. We should derive little rejoicing for what has transpired. And these setbacks should not prompt us to discount Mr. Khrushchev or the strength of the communist bloc in the world, or to deal lightly with the urgent disarmament problem, or to brush aside his demand for another summit conference. Actually, the free world has won little at the United Nations in these sessions so far. The pressures are mounting, and they are not all communist inspired. The world is bitterly resentful and unhappy about the resumption of the Cold War, which is on, and the dread possibility that it may lead actual war, nuclear war, the universal Holocaust, which everybody dreads. In the words which Mr. Khrushchev uttered at the United Nations, the delegates and the listening world detected much that was brash, boasting, bluster, but also much that was very ominous, very dangerous, very alarming. He said, You want to compete with us in the arms race? We will beat you in that. Production of rockets is now a matter of mass delivery, like sausages that come out of an automatic machine. Of course, you're going to complain all over the place, Khrushchev is threatening. Well, he's not threatening. He's really predicting the future. The arms race will go on, and this will bring about war, and in that war you will lose, and many of those sitting here will not be found any longer, and not many, but perhaps all. You are accustomed to listen to words that lull you, but as for Khrushchev, I do not wish to pat your heads when the world is on the verge of catastrophe. You want to listen to pleasant words? Well, if these words are unpleasant, that means I have achieved my purpose. That is exactly what I intended. The subject of disarmament remains the most urgent and pressing problem before the whole world today. Now the West has presented a disarmament proposal to the United Nations. These proposals call for a program of general and complete disarmament under effective international control, which should be carried out progressively, with measures to be completed as rapidly as possible within specified periods of time. The Soviet insists on an immediate treaty on complete disarmament, with what appears to be imperfect controls or inspections. Now, if there is sincerity on both sides, an accommodation of views can certainly be found. But if there is no sincerity, if one side is talking only for the record, and the other to win converts to communism, then the situation is desperately grave, one might almost say hopeless. The UN will rapidly move to dissolution. Is it the old League of Nations? Neither side, I am afraid, has so far failed to give clear and convincing proof of its complete sincerity in the matter of rapid and total disarmament. This is true also of another summit conference which is being called for. A new president of the United States, be it Vice President Nixon or Senator Kennedy, would be attending such a summit conference next year if it is called. A new representative of the United States. But the same old Khrushchev will be in attendance. The man who wrecked the first summit conference on one pretext or another, and who has since then been pouring insult upon insult, one reckless charge upon another, and one vilification upon another, upon the United States. This is not a favorable climate for a summit conference. Mr. Khrushchev, I'm afraid, has been impaled upon the double horn of a dilemma. On the one hand, orthodox communist ideology, and on the other hand, his desire and the need of his people for coexistence with the capitalist world. And this inner contradiction, has made him so irascible and so unpredictable and so dangerous. He must live up to his communist credo, and he must satisfy so many of his party members as to his real orthodoxy, his real ideological orthodoxy. And so he shouts, "We will bury you, capitalists." But on the other hand, he must satisfy his people at home, who have now come to demand a higher standard of living, more consumer goods, a freer way of life, less disciplined militarily. And this can only come about as a result of cutting down the Soviet military budget before the people can have butter and bread instead of bullets. And this can come about only as a result of an agreement for peaceful coexistence between the East and the West. I am of the opinion that Mr. Khrushchev has really disqualified himself as a negotiator for the very coexistence policy which he favors with the Western world. And if his country and his people are sincere in wanting coexistence, and I believe that the Russian people want it as much as the people of the United States or of England or of any other country in the world, if they are sincere in wanting it, they should send someone else than Mr. Khrushchev. One less embroiled in scurrility and denunciations and affront. One less of the brawler and more of the statesman to such a summit conference. The Russians know how to replace one man by another, even under their dictatorial system. When a new policy is called for, a new situation arises, Mr. Molotov was replaced, Mr. Balankov was replaced, Mr. Khrushchev himself is a replacement. Mr. Khrushchev has failed to achieve his objective of coexistence. He does not seem likely to achieve it. Another man, less intemperate, better qualified for the task, might succeed. And certainly the West will more readily negotiate with a man who has not time and again spit upon it. The next move, in my judgment, is up to the Soviet. And the United States and the West must be prepared to welcome any move in the right direction and meet it more than halfway, in sincerity, in willingness, in forthrightness. The case is not at all one of all white and all black. The tumult and the shouting dies, the captains and the kings depart, still stands thine ancient sacrifice, a humble and a contrite heart. That's what we need. That's what the Russians need. That's what the whole world on the brink of disaster needs, a humble and a contrite heart. It must turn a new page. It must make a new beginning. It must repent. talk a great deal about national prestige. How many nations of the world are with us and how many are not with us? It's a pointless thing to talk about. President Lincoln, in the dark days of the Civil War, was once asked, "Mr. President, are you sure that God is on our side?" He said, "I'm not so much concerned with whether God is on our side, I'm concerned with whether we are on God's side." That's prestige. That's authority. That's strength. To be on God's side. It is important to know clearly that we are really on the side of humanity, on the side of progress, on the side of reconciliation, on the side of disarmament. That we are prepared to seize every opportunity to bring these moral, sound objectives to pass. We are at a stage now, either at the end or at the beginning. What has transpired in the United Nations, if you listen to the voice behind the clamor, shouting, and the tumult, you will hear the voice of admonition, of warning. It is later than you think. The tactics of the past are not good enough. The maneuvering is not good enough. The skillful manipulation of propaganda is not good enough. Throwing sand in people's eyes is not good enough. Honestly, earnestly, prayerfully, the whole world must make a new beginning. That we will have a United Nations where nations can bring their grievances. Problems can be negotiated and settled, and the world will make a new start towards a brighter future.